Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we continue this journey, we need to continue on a daily, if not hourly, appeal to heaven, which means that we need to continue to learn, pray, and act. And, folks, what we need to be doing is we need to be demanding and or calling upon all to seek full compliance to the rule of law, which means seek full compliance to the Constitution. In our Republican form of government, because we're going to get into that as soon as I wrap this up really quick, in our Republican form of government, the law is king. Nothing is above the law. And so that was one of those things that we were talking about. And welcome back, Sean. So that was one of the things that actually you were asking yesterday. What is a Republican form of government, right?
Correct.
A Republican form of government, and I kind of covered the representation side. It's a representative government, but in America, we changed that. We made a huge leap in acknowledging that when we create a government, we empower it to be sovereign over those things empowered. The people ultimately have the power of government comes from the people. The people have the power. But when you give government very specific powers, then that means you've relinquished those. When you've given somebody a power of attorney, you've relinquished that, or you're sharing that in some cases with that other person. And so the point is, when we create a government and we say, you will have the power to declare and prosecute war, that means the people don't have that power anymore. You will have the power to, you know, regulate our commerce going abroad and coming back in. You'll be able to tax us. You'll be able to make laws. And those, the more general we empower our government, the more problems we end up having. That has been the lifelong pursuit of a limited government, because government always wants, you know, everything. They want full power, you know, unabashed, you know, unvarnished. They want to be able to have access and control of everything. And so that's how monarchies were created. That's how all governments were created. And then people kept on stumbling into the exact same problems. Hey, we're getting oppressed here. And they would have to revolt, and they'd have to take back their government and retune it. But the one thing that they never did was they never created a hard set limit on what government could really do, which in the U.S. Constitution was the first constitution to actually do that, where it enumerated the very few things that they could create law on, and they gave them the ability to tax and how they could, you know, apply that tax. If you really look at it, it was very, very limited. And so as they created this new federal government, they also recognized that the governments that they had created at the state level, already the states had counties. And in the new states that were coming, they were being built as counties first and then state last when the state would join the union. So therefore, we had three governments in this hybrid constitutional republic. The government that has the least power or least involvement in every aspect of our life is the federal government. The next government that has less, or a little bit more than the federal government, but less than the county government, would be the state. And then the government that is closest to the people should have the ability to decide where a stop sign goes, because you don't want the federal government saying, we're going to put a stoplight or a roundabout here, because that's what they're doing. They're installing roundabouts. They've taken full control of our transportation system and everything. When they don't have that authority, we never gave it to them. And so the whole key is, in establishing, or actually not just establishing the government, but the key is identifying that that government is equally significant in representation at that next government level. To the state, it is significant that the county actually be involved. Now, I know that we're kind of just going to wrap this up. I'm going to wait for Tammy to join us tomorrow so that we can go through the state of Washington, because we kind of talked about how Washington State kind of created an appropriation. So I'll make sure that we kind of cover that at that point. But the real question is, have I run to ground? Have I completely exhausted this concept of what a Republican form of government is? Because the other component is, it is a rule, the rule of law, or the law is the king. We don't have kings, we have the law. And we created the law with these very defined powers, and everything was left to the people, or the states and the people, or the counties and the people. In other words, we're only giving up just a little bit to each of the governments and leaving the residual control to ourselves. The control over our family is to us, because we never gave any government the control of our family. Pause. So any questions? Did I run it to ground?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay.
I think you did a very good job.
Oh, okay.
Much better understanding.
All right, great. So the one thing that I need to do a go back on, because let me identify the gentleman here. I received a question, and the question came from, let me see here. It was sent to me by Cynthia, but it was King Arthur of Spamalot. That's his email handle, and I presume it's a he, because he said King Arthur. So anyway, he wanted to know where we get the clarity regarding the apportionment of 30,000 people. Is that in the ratification debates that creates this hard limit to the 30,000? And so, first off, actually, to answer King Arthur, the real meat of how this was going to be done as far as the apportionment and management of that number is found in the Constitutional Convention. Madison's notes are pretty thorough on this, because the original layout was that Congress was going to have control to regulate what that number was going to be. And that was the beginning. And over time, they started recognizing and realizing that you didn't want to give Congress too much power, especially control over themselves. So that's one of the reasons why their compensation was set and their benefits were set to only compensation for their time, so that they couldn't give themselves, you know, extra per diems and all these other things, which they're giving themselves, like health care and those types of things. The only thing that they can take out of the Treasury to basically receive any compensation is just that, compensation for their time. In other words, their salary. That's it. Every other dollar or penny that's going into their hands out of the Treasury is not constitutional. Now, I believe any formal travel, because that's not compensation, that's just covering what their costs are to travel, that's covered because it's official business, it's official duty. It's not compensation to them. They're not making money. So anyway, the 30,000 actually got set at the very end of the Constitutional Convention. It was George Washington, and if you read Madison's notes, I believe it's the 17th. They're getting ready to sign this thing, and Washington breaks, you know, his decorum. He kind of breaks, you know, from his form as the president and says, I know I have held my tongue for the entire convention, and at this point, I cannot. I do not believe that a person is adequately represented when they're competing with 40,000 people to a representative. And he made basically a quick case that that number was too high, that the representation needed to be a smaller number for the federal representatives in the House of Representatives and Congress. So somebody, I forget who it was, made the motion that it be set at 30,000. It was seconded, and it was unanimously passed. Therefore, the Constitution, before it was signed, was changed from 40,000 to 30,000. So that's where it got hard set. The fact that they placed it in Article 1, Section, I think it's 1, or actually I think it's probably Section 2, right? Yeah, so it's in Section 2. And that part of Article 1, Section 2, as well as Article 1, Section 1, and I would recommend anybody looking at the enumerations, the color codes of enumerations of the Constitution, because we identify what sections of the Constitution can Congress actually make laws or they have the power to change. They do not have the power to change what the age requirement and the years of citizenship is for a representative in the House of Representatives, or for a senator, or for the president. The only way those numbers can change, which is Article 1, Section 2, Article 1, Section 3, Article 2, Section 2, what have you, in, you know, so bottom line, they can't change that number of, you know, 30,000 representatives. The real key to this is, where's the proof in the pudding? In the Bill of Rights, the very first amendment in the 12 amendments in the Bill of Rights, because most people don't know that there were 12. They only passed 10. Technically, they actually passed the First Amendment. The First Amendment isn't about religion and speech and all of that. The First Amendment was the Apportionment Amendment. So we're going to get to that in probably the next couple of days. So we'll dive into it in the details of the language then. But Madison realized that over time the republic would grow, and when they create this room of, you know, for representation, that it will end up, you know, they'll end up outgrowing it. And they needed a mechanism to be able to slowly fill it in and slowly not give them time to not outgrow it to a great magnitude to allow them to possibly either build a new chamber for the House of Representatives or and all of Congress, or change that number by an amendment. So he submitted an amendment that would actually allow that number to change from 30,000 to 40,000 once there were 100 representatives in the House of Representatives. And it would change again when they got to 200 to 50,000, and it would be capped at 50,000 based on that amendment. Now, if you do the research, you're going to find that Connecticut actually did ratify that one amendment. Basically, it got buried, got put in a folder, and it went into some drawer, and for the longest time, it was just sitting in obscurity until they finally realized, hey, the state legislature actually ratified that amendment. This was just recently discovered. And so technically, it was ratified, but the state of Connecticut has not forwarded that to actually say, hey, we actually ratified this on this particular day, which means that that amendment would go into effect. The reason everybody is avoiding this is because it would literally force the number that Congress and the Congressional Reapportionment Act in 1929, Congress said, hey, we have to change these numbers and we have to take control of this. So they passed an act to empower them. Instead, in other words, they said, we're not going to follow this constitutional process of having to amend the Constitution when, you know, we know better, and we're going to just empower ourselves. And watch, the states aren't going to do anything, and the states did nothing. Just like the states have continually done nothing, even when Madison and Jefferson tried to get them to do something. Either the states are going to step up and save this republic, or we're dead. We're going to get thrown into the arms of the globalists. The only thing that will save us, legitimately save us, are the states. This is why Madison educated everybody in 1789, or 1798, I should say. And he further educated people for the rest of his life in different correspondences to help people really understand how and why the power resides in the states. Just like when it comes to your county government, the power lies and resides in the people. That's the only government where the power really resides and lies in controlling that government. in the state government who created the state, not the people. It wasn't done by, you know, everybody of the state going into one big room and having a convention. No, they sent delegates from the counties. And each county was equally represented, and each county equally voted, because the sovereignty of the county was just like the sovereignty of the states. It was protected. And in the state of Washington, we're going to prove this, that the sovereignty of the county was equally protected. And so this right here is actually going to lay, you know, the huge, I'll just say maybe the icebreaker, that will end up breaking the Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims decisions that came from the Warren Court, where they unconstitutionally backhanded the states and how they configured themselves and how they chose to govern themselves. So anyway, I hope that covers everything. When you go into the ratification base regarding that number of apportionment, when you go in there, you're going to find that this hard number of 30,000 was argued back and forth by the Federalists. The Anti-Federalists said, oh, that's too high. They wanted to change, you know, the times of voting from once every 2 years to once a year. There were those little, I'll call them petty arguments. But when it came down to understanding that that was a hard fixed number, I don't think that was ever disputed in any of the ratification debates. It was just, it was completely affirmed and agreed to. Other than they wanted to change it one way or change the term limits, that type of stuff. Bottom line, the little barbs. Now, you got to remember that when you're reading debates, like the debates of Congress, or when you're reading the ratification debates, there may be people that are making these arguments. But that doesn't mean that that argument is a prevailing argument. What I'm saying is when you read, and the 14th Amendment is a really good example, because the 14th Amendment, you see all sorts of anti-14th Amendment arguments in the debates. They're saying this. They keep on saying this. And I think this is where some of the bad information got inserted, because, you know, here's a representative or a senator basically using hyperbole. This is going to destroy us. It's almost like when George Mason said that the federal government is going to have this huge cauldron of stirring up evil. I mean, it's hyperbole. The reality is everybody in that room knew that that was hyperbole coming from Mason, just like these other anti-14th Amendment players. Keep in mind, when it came down to getting it into the hands of the House of the Whole, or the body of the whole, which means when the House of Representatives said, okay, we've pounded out everything that we want, this is the language we all agree upon, and when I say the prevailing, the two-thirds, they finally got to two-thirds of the House, they said, let's vote on it, and it passed with two-thirds, even though you still had all of these ancillary hyperbole or all of these shock value arguments being thrown out by a very minority class of people. So in other words, when you're reading that, you go, wow, it's really going down the line here, but not at all. The people that are getting up contending against something doesn't mean that they have the, you know, that thought is equally shared with a large body of the people in that room. Does that make sense, Sean?
Yes, sir. It's kind of like a threat to democracy.
Yeah, right. Because most people, when they see the comments going back and forth, you go, wow, it sounds like it's pretty close. And in the 14th Amendment, I use that as a great example, because as soon as they put their pens down to go, okay, we got something, boom, two-thirds of the House voted for it. I mean, over two-thirds. So in other words, the prevailing thought wasn't those negative barbs that were being thrown out. The prevailing thought is they need to secure the privileges and immunities and equal protection under the law, and, you know, getting and holding people fully accountable to their oath. They needed to secure those things into an amendment, though there may be evildoers. So this is what I recommend. When you're looking at the debates in Congress, when you're looking at the ratification debates, do yourself a favor. Go to the very end before you read anything and list the names of the people that are against, who voted against the amendment. Look at those people who sorry about that. Look at those people who actually made those comments and highlight their names so that you actually put them in red. And then you now know that though this person is literally a person that's making negative comments and they're not on board and they're going to vote against it. And ultimately they did. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
You see it all the time now.
Right, right. But if you do that, then when you read their comments, or actually you're better off ignoring their comments, because it's not like they're contributing to explaining the Constitution. It's not like they're contributing to explaining this amendment. They're doing anything and everything they can to stop it. The best thing to do, because I would tell people to color it in red, but sometimes you want to use color codes for very specific things, because when you really start using color, like highlights and coloring the text and so forth, you kind of run out of colors. And so the best thing you can do, this is what my suggestion would be, is you take the font and everything that is the anti-federalist from the person talking throughout everything that they said, and highlight, or actually change the font to white. You know what that'll do?
Make it disappear.
That's right. Now all of a sudden you can't see anything because the page is white and the font is white. It's just a white space. That's all it is. You're not deleting it, but now you take away the noise completely, because you know sometimes when you see the text, a word jumps out, convention, you know, or murder, you know, or whatever. Because in many cases, like Colburn, when George Mason said that. And I myself, this is something I learned from Professor Kurt Lash a long time ago when he did a deep dive on the 14th Amendment. It was basically a thesis that he did. It's three parts, it's thousands of pages, on the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. And so he kind of talks about making sure that you ignore the comments and the hyperbole coming from the anti, or the opponents to whatever's passing, the amendment or the Constitution, what have you. And so, you know, okay. Well, I found that, you know, reading what Patrick Henry had to say, I thought was pretty important, because in his day, compared to the 14th Amendment day, you know, Patrick Henry was really saying some really important things, or, you know, insightful things. Like one of the things that if I never had read what he said, I wouldn't know that he was emphatically telling everybody that this is a new government. This isn't your old government. This isn't, you know, any government we've ever seen before. This is a new government. And, you know, I think that one, he was actually amazed by it. And I believe after he failed in subverting the Constitution and it taking effect and it succeeding in moving forward, I think he finally did make some positive comments regarding the Constitution. I mean, he put aside, you know, his sour grapes attitude as the fox walks away from the grapes because he couldn't get to them. And he actually started saying, you know, this is a good thing. I think that that's the same thing with George Mason. Many of these good men were just, they were so hung up on the importance of a Bill of Rights, the importance of this, the importance of this. They hunkered down. I mean, it was fight to the end to try to stop this. There were people, and I don't think that there weren't evil people, but I don't think that the propensity or the amount of really bad players in the days of the Constitution and the ratification was anywhere near what we had in the time of the 14th Amendment. Because we already see this drifting away. We see this concern, because it's in the 14th Amendment, of holding people accountable, about holding them to this thing called moral perjury. It was Senator Howard that basically clarified that the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was identifying that when you violate your oath, you've committed moral perjury. And as far as you know, anybody should be concerned. You should not be able to stay in office if you committed moral perjury about that very oath that you, your name has basically been affixed to, that you would die supporting it. So anyway, we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Well, it seems like the first part of this show really just took a turn and kind of got away from me. But that being said, I wanted to run to ground this idea or this question because I think it was just yesterday or the day before. I said, hey, any of you have a question, you want clarity on something we've already covered, just let me know and we'll respond. And so to King Arthur Sir Spamalot or King Arthur Spamalot, there you go. You won't find much in the ratification base. There's really not a challenge of what that is. Now, the reality is, how did they count that? Now, the intent was that they were going to apply a slave, three-fourths or three-fifths of a slave. In other words, a slave was three-fifths of a person. So they had to mathematically calculate for every slave that three-fifths proportion so that they could then come to what the number was for the, you know, the different states that had slavery. Now, I would venture to say, and actually if you go through the representation in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, and you look at the representation in 1790 after they did the census, and then look at how many people were represented the states in the House of Representatives, you would probably find that the number didn't jump like New York did, like these other states that were free states that actually abolished slavery, where, you know, the concept of plantations were really going away, and this concept and moving towards, you know, factories, production, those types of things. Not like people weren't still growing their food and so forth, but they were innovating because, and Thomas Sowell points this out, if you've never read it, and I highly recommend it, Black Rednecks, White Liberals, then if you read that book, it literally lays out the disparity in the paradigms between those states that gave up slavery and those states that clung to it. Because you could travel down the Ohio or whatever that river was that kind of traversed that Mason-Dixon line as it's on its way into the South, that on the north side, you would see pastures, cow pastures that were detreed, you know, where there was plenty of grass. It was just a beautiful, if you were a cow, that's where you wanted to be. And then when you looked on the other side, you would see, most of the trees weren't even cut down. There was hardly any grass for the cows to eat. And so the cows were over on the south suffering, which is why the north actually was outproducing the south in butter, dairy products, and those types of things. Why? Because the only people that were doing the full job were those big plantations. But on the north side, everybody knew that that's what you needed to do to get the most out of what you got. But there was a lot of slothfulness and laziness that just was, and this is what Sowell points out. He says you could really see why the South was constantly having problems, because they were they had a lazy culture. And so when you look at what happened, are you familiar with what happened on the Trail of Tears?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The Southerners went to Jackson, President Jackson, and said, "We got to get rid of these Indians because they're beating us. They're, you know, they've got a paper, they're outproducing us, and we can't, you know, we can't survive. They're going to take everything from us." They were beating them at their own game. Did you know that?
No, I was not aware of that.
Right. Because they were becoming successful in capitalism. And, you know, bringing the money from, you know, the white people into, you know, the tribal, or I should say, into their farms, into their businesses, because they were working hard. And, you know, if you want to beat somebody, all you got to do is work hard. So anyway. All right. So for that, at this point, that kind of wraps up, I think. Anything else? Anything else you want to bring up regarding the 30,000?
I wanted to mention you were talking about apportionment and the 30,000 person limit.
Yeah.
I did the math on the population, current population of the U.S., which is 347 million. And we would need 11,576 representatives in the House of Representatives to match that.
Okay, so what number are you coming up with for the population?
347,275,807.
So
that's what I got off the internet. That's
okay. So how many invaders are in that number? Because that's the total number of people that are in America today, right? Right. We're not differentiating, because when they took the census, they counted invaders. I don't know if you knew that. As a matter of fact, Jimmy Carter in 1980, when he took over, because he got the census year, he was elected in the census year. So when they kicked off the census under his administration, he told them that we're going to count all of the invaders, and we're going to account representation to them, which actually helped a big jump in representation in the House of Representatives to shift towards those states that actually had more invaders in them and so forth, which gave California a lot more. So when you look at that number, so the other question is, you're looking that even a baby gets representation. And I don't think that was the case. I think you had to be what they would call a person or a citizen. So we'd have to come up with what the real number of representation would be. Now, another thing that they could have, but they didn't, because slaves were given representation. So when the federal government came down to the individual, not property holder, but in many states, the property holder was the person. He's the person that voted. And the house or the taxation was placed upon the property and so forth. So the question is, what is the most accurate number that you can come up with that would say, okay, how many kids are in school today? Because I think you could actually pull in how many children from high school down and how many kids are coming into the pipeline, because I think you could even get that number right there. But that includes invaders as well. But I'm just saying that working that number down to an accurate number would probably give us somewhere probably closer to half that, if not less than half that. Does that make sense?
Well, what I'm getting right now is 310 million, because they're assuming that there's 24 to 25 million non-citizens.
So it's coming up with how many? What's the number now?
310 million.
Okay, so in 2018 or 2017, MIT and Yale did a study on how many invaders at that point in Trump's administration were they accounting for, and at that point they were counting for 20 some million. At that point, they were. Now you got to remember that this is a very liberal schools, and they probably didn't count the DACA or those people that they just considered that, you know, they folded them in because they're on the path of amnesty, what have you. Right. So when you really boil it down, because I'm going to tell you that, okay, so that's the invaders, but what about the refugees that have been brought here? Because there's no constitutionality for them to be here either. There should be no path for them to citizenship because the federal government didn't have the authority to bring them here in the first place. In other words, they are the poisonous fruit of the tree. The act bringing them here was wrong, so everything about them being here needs to be undone. That goes all the way back to Vietnam, folks, and so forth. And so we have to come to a point of, okay, those people back then, but today, folks, all the Islamists that have been brought here, all the, MS-13 or whatever those, the gang members and so forth. I mean, there you go. So that's no brainer. Those guys go back, period. And we got to try to find that line to say, you know, they've been integrated too far. And actually, most of the people in the early days of refugees wanted to integrate. But today, they don't. Today, the invaders don't want to integrate. They're here to destroy us. So we have to, you know, really come down to what that real number is. And I'm going to guess that it's probably closer to somewhere under 200,000, because you got to take the kids out of this as well. So I'm going to guess it's probably closer to about 200,000 or less. So now, what would that number be based on that?
200 million?
200 million, yeah, 200 million. Yeah, you're right.
6,666.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. The 6666. So,
yes.
Yeah, so I get it. So,
two-thirds.
Right, but that's probably a more accurate number. It's, you know, it's half of what we were looking at, or somewhere about half or less, possibly. So the real question is how do we get there? And as a matter of fact, this is another no-brainer. So you can have what we would call a delegation, right? So each state is a delegation of representatives, right? So Wyoming would jump from one representative to whatever 30,000 divided into 500 or half a million would be, somewhere there, whatever that number is, right? It's going to be more than 10. But anyway, from jumping from one to whatever, they would have a delegation. And what each delegation would do every 2 years would be able to break down the state into regions or into basically smaller groups of delegations, which would then allow for not the watering down of representation, but a ability to develop leadership that wouldn't be affected by geographics. In other words, when you look at California, one would probably say that there would be a great likelihood that California would easily be, you know, led by Nancy Pelosi and those types of people. But if you segregate them into geographical regions where you basically give them one vote, in other words, you break down LA, that's going to be still a lot of people, but that gives them one vote, or you start splitting that. Because when you look at the LA basin, there are large bases or large areas that are what I would say conservative, like Riverside, San Bernardino, Ventura, or whatever that county is. I forget what that county is. But Orange County.
Probably all the people that got their houses burned down by now.
Oh, you think that they would have seen the error of their ways, but, you know, some people are just diehard. They're just, you can't fix stupid, right? So my point is that if you do it in a way that actually gives equal representation across the state, where everybody has, you know, this democracy of choosing who the leadership would be. And I would basically say, if you have a certain amount of representation over a certain threshold, like California, then I would say that your delegation would be broken up by those areas, which would guarantee representation for the agricultural areas and the forest areas and the other parts of the states. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the only people that would be actually be sitting in D.C. would be these leaders of these areas, and everybody else would be literally going to work at their county offices. Because when you have you ever seen the counties of the states and the population of the counties? Have I ever sent that to you? I need to send that to you, because when you actually start looking at the counties, we've got probably 1,000 counties that are about 30,000 people. Now, 30,000 people means children and everybody, right? So you really need to get somewhere around 40, not even 40, because if you just figure the numbers of 40% of the people are families, that means that you've got, you know, two people together with kids, then you could count at least you got one kid a household or whatever. So then that creates this watering down to where, what would that real number be at the county level where you would have your own representative not shared with anybody? What's that sweet number? And it's going to be more than 30,000, but when you look at how many counties in America where the population is about 30,000, it's about 1,000, it's one-third, which is a pretty decent thing that you can actually, counties would actually become relevant again. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so as we start looking at it, because we got to remember, it's not about, the relevance isn't in population or democracy. The relevance is in the local communities and the governments you've created for yourselves. The whole point of the federal government was to preserve the sovereignty of the states. And we missed this because it didn't get ingrained, or it wasn't embossed or, you know, galvanized in the state constitutions that the sovereignty of the counties would be preserved. So that's why it's really important when we start taking back the counties, people start understanding this, because those people over there in those population centers are going to want to have a democracy and control over you, because they don't like the way you think. And that right there is a problem that has to be dealt with. And so bottom line, when it comes down to the conventions, the counties actually vote by delegation, which means that each delegation gets one vote each, just like a state in the convention. A county in the convention, each county gets one vote. Which means all those people that live in King County, where Seattle is, they're not going to be happy that they only get one vote. It doesn't matter. You chose to live there. You decided to stack up and build a house on top of somebody else and on top of somebody else and so forth. Well, that doesn't mean you're going to gain more representation or better representation in this type of republic. And you want to change that, then start subdividing your county down to a county being a block. Now you're starting to work in the right direction if you want to do something like that. But good luck. Good luck, because you'd actually have to create your own water system, your own electricity. In other words, in some of those things, you'd have to be able to provide for yourself. And what would end up happening, because this is why the people would be very resistant, when you create that much local government, the people actually have to pay for all of that. Right?
Correct.
So this goes down this path, and I don't think I ever made this comment. So what is a government? A government is an entity that must be able to sustain itself, right?
Yes.
In other words, you don't want to create a government where you're dependent on going to other governments and paying you your salary, feeding you, and taking care of you. Unless you're really good in warfare, to where you can go and conquer them and enslave them, where they pay for everything you do. Right? I mean, that's a good way of, you know, taking care of yourself, but that's not a, you know, It's not necessarily a nice way, nor is it a civil way, or even more importantly, it's not within the paradigm of sovereignty, individual liberty, individual sovereignty, those types of things. So bottom line, when you look at this county listing, you're going to find that there are counties that actually have less than 100 people, 200, 300 people. And if you're going to have a sheriff, how much do those people have to pay? And if you really think about where these counties are probably located, they're probably located in a very rural area where I guess if you could go to that county government and say, what is the average household income of this county? It probably be pretty low, right?
I think so.
I wouldn't think that a county out in the middle of the desert in Texas would, you know, have a lot of millionaires living out there. So, in other words, the people are just, you know, strapping and trying just to survive. The reality is that there are way too many counties that have been created that shouldn't be created because they can't sustain themselves. They don't have the tax base, right? When you actually create your representation, your legislators for the county, you've got your sheriff and whatever else you need to give that sheriff, like, you know, a couple of cars and a jail, and all, that costs money. So you have to come to this bottom line of what is it and how many people, or what is the total income or the GDP of that county, so that you can say, okay, that county has enough depth to where it can sustain itself. Because I'm going to tell you, when you look at counties of maybe 30,000, that might be that threshold of where you can kind of sustain yourself, depending on how much county is providing the people. So we have to start, you know, having, this is a real adult conversation that most people haven't even thought that they needed to have. Right? Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
I mean, the
people that are most concerned with liberty and that's how they live their lives, they really don't want to be involved with government. You know, most of the people I know who are foundational people that believe in liberty and individualism, they're not interested whatsoever in being involved in the government. I think that's how we ended up where we are now.
Yes. And so there's actually people out there that think, you know, they're restoring everything, you know, like the jural assemblies. You got these jural assemblies of maybe 100 people in the whole state, 100. And they feel like, you know, they've got the adequate government to now, you know, take control and to provide, you know, the necessary services for the people of the state and or even the county. And I'm going, you know, how pretentious is that? Anyway, so as we kind of look, because we're going to get in now to Article 5. And we were going to do this. We started going down this path yesterday where we were kind of dividing this between you and Tammy. And so there are two paths here. There's the congressional path, and then there's the state path. The congressional path is where Congress creates an amendment, and they basically forward that amendment, but they can't forward the amendment until two-thirds of Congress pass that amendment. In other words, they have to vote on it, just like the 14th Amendment, like I was saying earlier. The 14th Amendment quickly passed with over two-thirds of each house voting to pass that on, to forward it to the states. Therefore, when you look at the state's path, the Congress can create any amendment they want, but it doesn't become an amendment until we have three-fourths of the states ratifying it. Now, the other path is what we call the state's path. And that's when two-thirds of the states choose to convene a convention to create a constitution or create amendments to the constitution, changes to the constitution. They can rewrite it, or they can make very, you know, specific changes. So what we want to do is kind of go through this, and when we think we've hit the language of that, because the way it meanders, it kind of includes everything in an overview as you read this, or as we will find when you read this. So go ahead and start with the congresswoman.
Article 5.
Right.
The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which, in either case, shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution, when ratified by legislatures of three-fourths of the several states, or by conventions in three-fourths thereof.
Okay, so stopping right there. Mm-hmm. They're basically pointing out that any amendment or change, new wholesale change, or any amendment, whether it comes from the congressional path or whether it comes from the convention path, it requires three-fourths of all of the states. Now, this is here hard-coded in the Constitution. And granted, the Articles of Confederation said that the Articles of Confederation, you know, can't change without going down this path of creating this new Constitution, which is what they did. And they said, well, this can be changed. In other words, the John Birchers and others are saying that they can rewrite the Constitution and actually change what this requirement is by creating a whole new Constitution. And ergo, by creating this democracy and saying that we want to actually go back to, you know, this wacko bad government. We want to, you know, open ourselves up to tyranny and anarchy. And so, but it'll only take 51% of the states. In other words, it'll take 27 states to ratify, because that would be 51%. And so that could go out there and that could linger. So that, you know, but the reality is that in this particular Constitution, it requires three-fourths of the states for that other amendment or Constitution become ratified. They may be changing it, but here's the question. Now, because we're going into the end of the show here, do you believe, when you look at the states, the red states versus the blue states. Now, because we're going to end the show, so when we come back tomorrow, you can do the research on this. But you tell me if they could come close to actually ratifying by a simple majority of a constitution that completely gets away, deviates, and really takes us down the wrong path. Do you think that type of a convention could succeed with a majority vote of red states, or including the red states, to go on board with that? Does that make sense?
What you said makes sense,
okay.
But I don't think it would ever happen.
Okay, so when we come back tomorrow, we'll dive into it, and then we'll get back into this with Tammy. Because what's really important here is what is the outcome. And actually, the one thing that we haven't even brought up, and I'll bring this up tomorrow, is that the Article 5 is in the Constitution. It arises under the Constitution, which means the federal courts will have jurisdiction over this. And so they ultimately have the control over it. So we will be back. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.